So how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
Buy a ticket. Sure as heck is easier than practicing.
You are likely to be eaten.
You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory. You are likely to be eaten by a group. If this predicament seems particularly cruel, consider whose fault it could be. Now the torture of a match in your inventory.
Let's see. Yay, all excited to talk about it. Should we start with mail?
I think we should just dive in.
Yeah? Excellent.
Yeah. Okay. Hit me with the mail.
Stick. Hit me with the mail. Here's the mail. It never fails. Makes me want to wag my tail. When it comes, I want to wail. Mail.
I can't believe we had MC Frontalot. We could have just used you.
That's straight out of Blue's Clues. You can't go wrong with Blue's Clues.
So who wrote us?
Who wrote us?
And what did they have to say?
I think I have four males of note, I think. And one female. Hey-o. David Motowayek wrote in. He said, "Hey, guys, I discovered your podcast yesterday and was thrilled to see a show covering one of my favorite software publishers. I have such fond nostalgia for Infocom and glad to see they're getting some love. I recall going to my local computer store back in the early 80s, money in pocket, and trying out several of the Infocom games with the store owners. They highly recommended Enchanter, and that is the game I brought home with me. In fact, it was the first game I ever bought for my Commodore 64. I played through the game and loved every minute of it. I somehow managed to finish it, but assume I got a few hints along the way. I probably looked up some hints on either Genie or CompuServe, as I was big into modems and online services at the time. I even printed a transcript of the game's story to my dot matrix printer and read it like I would a short story. I've been wanting to play some of these games again, and this sounds like the perfect opportunity along with the podcast. I did play through Wishbringer a couple of months ago and would say it's a good starter game for those who are new to interactive fiction. However, I do admit I needed a hint or two to get through the game. You might want to mention there are modern ways to play these games that don't require emulation. I use a program called Zoom for the Mac, which is a Z code interpreter that will run all the Infocom games. It works well, and I know there are other programs to do the same thing. Frotz is another one. Sadly, I no longer have my Infocom game collection and wish I held onto the many games I still have. I still do have the two-volume Lost Treasure compilations which have beautiful boxes, but all the original items are basically reduced to photocopies. Still, they are nice packages. Thanks for doing the show. Looking forward to future episodes."
Well, we all know from last episode that the Lost Treasures occasionally leaves out a page that frustrates one of the podcasters.
Yes. So that was a... It just did it on purpose. The games weren't hard enough on their own, so they just need to...
It's like an extra little meta puzzle.
Right, right. You want to read some mail, or am I just going to read all of it? What do you want to do?
I can read mail. I've got mail. Okay. Charles, friend of the show, Charles Magnum, wrote in to say, "Back in the day, and even now, I steer away from mystery-style games like Ballyhoo, which is also a fish in addition to being a cacophony. I prefer, instead, games with science fiction or fantasy settings. Do you have a preference for interactive fiction that happens in a version of the real world or a fantastic world?" I thought that was a fantastic question.
It is a fantastic world. I don't know. I don't know if I have an opinion yet. Maybe I do. I think I tend to like... the science fiction-y ones. I know I had fun a couple of 3 years ago playing Planetfall, and I tend to enjoy in general a sci-fi story more than a underworld D&D sort of Zork-like story. So I think I tend towards that sort of thing. How about you?
I think I'm the same. I have played far more interactive fiction, including Infocom games and stuff, or of any sort, that are fantasy or science fiction based, because I like genre works anyway. So those are simply the ones that I have leaned toward. I can't even think of an example of one that's not sci-fi or fantasy that I've... Oh, you know what? Ah, here's the thing to mention. In our very first episode, in the show notes, we put in the results from IF Comp 2016, mm-hmm. but we never actually talked about it. So no. Now I can talk about it because I actually played a couple of the games. I went and played two of them. I played one called 500 Apocalypses, which was, I think... tied for 18th place, and I also played Detective Land, which was the first place one. And they both had really neat interfaces. They were very different from Infocom games in their interface, in all of that. And Detective Land is, well, still genre, not science fiction. And I really liked it. I liked it a lot. So there's an example of one. 500 Apocalypses I liked, but I didn't get through. I kind of just, it's more like a musing of things. I like the idea behind it. It's like you found sort of like an encyclopedia, a galactic encyclopedia, that details kind of in poetry the apocalypse that destroyed a civilization on a given planet. So it was a neat idea that there'd be 500 apocalyptic poems, but I sort of just dipped in and read a few of them, and I didn't really get into the game. But Detective Land was amazing.
I played and this might have been part of what got me into the brain space of doing this podcast in the first place. I played several of the IF Comp games, maybe six or seven of them, in order to, for your judging to be counted, you have to judge at least five games. So I did five, then I think I got to six or seven. But what I like about these games, one of the things I like about them, is they are designed to be short. I mean, I think they have to be finished, or at least you have to do the judging after maximum 2 hours of play. So these aren't long games that take hours and hours like certain Infocom games we have played.
Like all Infocom games.
Yeah. I was. I'll tell you. I have another thing to talk about later. So I played Stone Harbor, which I was just picking these almost randomly. And Stone Harbor is definitely interactive fiction, but it's not a parser-based game. It's more like a story with clicking, you know? So I enjoyed it quite a bit, and that happened to have gotten fourth place in the competition. Definitely a different kind of interactive fiction than the parser-based stuff. I did a game called Fair, about a science fair, which, frankly, I only thought was fair. Not my favorite. One of my favorites...
I shouldn't laugh. It just encourages you.
One of the ones I liked, which only got 10th place, was a little game called How to Win at Rock, Paper, Scissors, which was just like the perfect little game for me. I really enjoyed it. It was super cute and a little sad, but cute. Let's see. I'm scrolling down. There was a couple I really didn't like. And anyway, so yeah, I love the IF Comp, and it's an annual thing where you know people do short interactive fiction. You can try them out, and it's kind of like a film festival for short interactive fiction.
And to let listeners know, you don't have to be judging things or play these games during the competition. I came after the fact, so I got to look at the list of winners. That's why I picked Detective Land, because it was the first place, so I thought, well, I'll try that. And then I picked another one just because I liked the premise. So you could go there now and look at the winners and read the descriptions and pick any or all of them to play. So everything
Absolutely.
Is still available.
And now that judging is done, I mean, you can kind of cherry pick the best ones because people have done the work of judging for you. And then after you've done, you know, you played the 58 things that were entered in this competition. This competition has been going on for years. So, I mean, it's created a ton of great interactive fiction.
I agree.
Yeah. No, I was mentioning, this is kind of apropos of nothing, but my daughter was visiting from college for 24 hours. And I mentioned that I was doing this podcast, and I was kind of talking about the Infocom games, and I said, but you know, she's played some interactive fiction, she's written some interactive fiction because she's awesome, and I said, you know, but the IF now is different from the way it was then. I mean, back then there was just these incomprehensible puzzles, and you'd have to like think about things for, you know, it could take weeks to solve something, and you needed hints and help. And she's just like, well, that's just bad game design, and blah blah blah. And I was just like, well, Maybe, but it's different now than it was then, because I think people's expectations have changed. And back then, when you're paying whatever, $40 or $50 for a game, which, you know, is in today's money is even more, people expected gameplay time. And which included sitting on the bus on the way to work puzzling over how to get the babelfish in your ear or whatever. I mean, I think people expected to really have to work for get the value of their money, which included just hitting your head against the wall for a month, you know?
Mm-hmm. So. I used to, as a kid, place more stock in that and more value in that. I love the Infocom games, and I'm very excited to play the rest of these and spend the time on them and such. But when I was a kid, a game that would promise dozens or, you know, hundreds of hours of gameplay was a value add to me. Like, that's amazing. I'm going to get more for my money. But now, as a busy adult, when, like, a PS4 game advertises that it's, you know, 100 hours of gameplay, I'm like, ugh.
That really? Sounds is exhausting.
There, is there a 10-hour version of that?
Right.
Can we do a little less farming and more just straight to the plot? Because 10 hours is good. I'll still give you the same money, but please, I got a busy life.
Right. Yeah, let's get to the good stuff. Yeah.
Mm.
A couple more pieces of mail here. This one from Adam Sampson says, really enjoying Eaten by a Grew. The world could always use more interactive fiction podcasts. That's very true.
We are the only one.
Well, that's true.
Look for others. They don't exist. Trust me.
I researched before. Eventually, we'll talk about one day. We'll talk about the ones that existed before this one that I researched.
Well, I would assume they've all just stopped podcasting now. Like, there's not a reason.
Oh, yeah. There's no really no point. They saw us coming all. And just stopped months before we even started.
Even before we decided to do it, there was like a disturbance.
Right.
We could tell.
Oh, yeah,
there's something in the air.
Oh, we need to stop now. Yes. You mentioned doing a Let's Play for Infocom game in episode 2. Apparently, that's something we said. There are a couple of examples.
Oh, yeah. I kind of joked about it. Wait, there's examples of that?
There are a couple of examples of this already.
Goodness.
Yeah. Ryan Veeder and Jenny Paldona's Clash of the Type-Ins podcast.
Oh, good name.
Yeah.
That's a good name.
They get the game author to read the game's responses, which works really well. They've not... Oh, my wife is printing, so you're going to hear printing noises now. They got the game's author to read the game's responses, which works really well. They've not done any Infocom games yet, but many notable IF authors have done an episode or two. Hey, if only there were somebody who'd previously interviewed Infocom authors who would give them a prod in that direction. Cough, cough. Yeah. And then, so that's number one, and then there'll be a link to that in the show notes. And then Club Floyd, there's a bot on the IF mud that allows people to play interactive fiction games as a group, and they've done all sorts of games, including several from Infocom, Level 9, etc. Jacqueline A. Lott Ashwell, that's a great name, Jacqueline A. Lott Ashwell, has a great archive of transcripts. The Zork 1 transcript there is particularly good since it was done by someone who'd never played the games before.
Oh, nice. Yeah, a lot of transcripts. When occasionally I'll go looking for hints or such, if you come across a transcript, it is clearly done by somebody who's basically memorized the game. They go immediately to every solution and do it perfectly. That is not how any of my transcripts would look if you looked at the way I play the game. A lot of going in circles, a lot of restarting, a lot of dead ends, a lot of trying stuff, a lot of beating my head against the keyboard.
When I was cheating on a Trinity, I needed to find a walkthrough, and I ended up finding one created by a person by David Wellborn, who has a Patreon, and his Patreon is creating interactive fiction walkthroughs. And
nice.
This is like a current thing he's currently doing, and Trinity is one of the ones that he did and who helped me get through that game. Lots of people doing interesting things with IF. And finally, Adam says, you also talked about games for beginners. In addition to the Infocom games you recommended, could I also suggest some more recent and perhaps user-friendly or puzzly games? He recommends Adam Plotkin's The Dream Hold, which has a really nice tutorial mode for people who've never played IF before, and Admiral Jota's Lost Pig, which...
Oh, I played that.
That's a fun game. I enjoyed that.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, I would highly recommend that one as well. That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's one of my I played that a few years ago, and that's definitely a lot of fun. And I think I have one more piece of mail, which you want to read if you want, from Michael Lenitsky, Michael, who managed to send this in like an hour before we recorded this. Good job, Michael, for making it under the wire. He said, I had many Infocom games in the 80s for my Commodore 128 and wish I still had them. They went the way of the dodo when I switched to IBM. Being a retired cop, my favorites were always the mysteries. I was lucky enough to finish The Witness, Moon Miss, Suspect, and Ballyhoo back in the day without any help. As you
Impressive.
Mm-hmm. He could be lying. He's either a liar or a cheater.
I'm or a he's cheater. Just skilled better at this than us, oh, yeah. Which is more likely.
Oh, yeah, quite possibly. As you can see, we are either those are either standard or easy. I was never able to finish Deadline or my favorite all-time Infocom game, Sherlock, Riddle of the Crown Jewels.
Oh, that's an interesting choice for favorite. You don't, that one doesn't come up that much.
No, that was one of the later ones that, I don't know much about, really.
Hmm.
I bought the Lost Treasures of Infocom on disc when it came out and still have all the maps and two books, which I treasure to this day. To upgrade, I bought the Activision Classic Text Adventure Masterpieces when it came out and still play the games today. Love the podcast and plan to play along with you as you go through the games.
Nice.
So, yay. Nice. Thank you for the mail, people.
I have a couple of others that people ask us questions.
Yes.
Didn't they? Jen wrote in. Oh, I'll read the middle part of hers. Okay. She said, if I may make a suggestion, it would be nice if you could, at the start of an episode, give a bit of a bird's eye view of what the game is about, the setting, who we're playing as, if known, what the goal is, that sort of thing. Not looking for anything too spoilery. It could be as simple as reading the blurb on the back of the box or paraphrasing the game intro. Yeah. I thought that was a fantastic suggestion.
That is. I think we get overexcited sometimes and just like want to jump straight into it. But yeah, definitely we should at least read the back of the box because it's not spoilers because it's marketing at that point.
Yeah, but I don't always have the box.
Oh, right.
We read the scan of the back of the box from Internet Archive.
Sure.
One other one, Roberta had written in saying, you talk a lot about cheating in the games, which I take to mean looking up answers to puzzles. Two questions. One, do you limit yourself to the kinds of cheating you do or take it in stages? For instance, is it okay to look at maps and read InvisiClues, but not just type solutions verbatim from a walkthrough? Or do you just dive in and go straight for the full answer if you get stuck? What say you, Kevin?
What kind of cheater are we? I like to take my cheating in baby steps. I like to use the InvisiClues, and one of the things I like them about them is they can often guide you in the right direction. So sometimes I will reveal one or two, and they're like, oh, okay, I see where they're going with this. And so I prefer that. I really try to do that when I can.
I am the same.
That said, on this game, on Trinity, I made a list of every time I needed a hint. I just go like, how much really did I cheat? I just kept like a running total. But by the end of the game, for the last section of the game, I had to walk through. I just had to give up. I was frustrated. It was taking forever. And I just had to go to David's walkthrough and just do what David said to do. So sometimes
I end up having the exact same experience. For that last section in particular, I looked at InvisiClues, I looked at the map, and then eventually I broke down and I read part of a walkthrough because I was like, this is crazy. Like, this is so hard. Right. And the timing is just insane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Roberta says, second question, too. You talked about how Ballyhoo sort of introduced the idea of a plot timeline that's a series of beats instead of a constantly moving clockwork timeline, and how the beats let you avoid having to play the same puzzles over and over using future knowledge to complete them. This reminded me of Graham Nelson's Bill of Player's Rights. Have you read that? It's from back in the 90s, and I don't think it was the first one. If I recall, one of the rights is to be able to win without the knowledge of future events or past lives. So it is your right to demand this of Infocom games.
Huh.
Will get you now, I do not know.
Yeah, no, I don't think that Trinity definitely does not preserve that right at all.
And we should get into this Trinity stuff, but the last section kind of moves it from the beat-based into more time-based. So now that that I think about it. It's anyway, let's talk about Trinity, and we can talk about how that actually does change, actually. I hadn't really thought that through. So Trinity, we're going to talk about Trinity.
We're going to talk about Trinity. Do you have the box there, or should I read it from the scan I have?
I don't have a box. Okay. This is one. I was disappointed to not have the box. I played it actually using Zoom on my Macintosh, which our listener had written in about, and that is exactly how I played this one.
I have not tried
Zoom yet. So far, I'm 3 for 3, different ways every time.
Excellent.
It worked really well.
Nice. I wanted to go a different way this time, so I fired up DOSBox, and I played the PC version on under emulation on my Mac.
Nice. I just don't like the PC DOS fonts. I like DOS games, but the font itself, a bit of a font snob, and I don't know if I want to play an Infocom game that way.
I liked it. I like the font, I guess. The font is fine for me, but I liked that it was in 80 columns versus some of the previous stuff I had done on the Atari was only 40 columns. And I liked that when I had done the version, the things I had used to play before had, when you save games, it had save slots. And depending, like the Atari version only had 5 slots per disk, and I think the Lost Treasures thing I had was using had 9 slots. But on the DOS version, you could just give it a file name. So I could name things like almost done dot save, or, you know, or temp, or whatever I wanted to call it, or, you know, stuck at the foo or whatever. So I like that, because that way
stuck
at the foo. And that way I could just kind of, it just made more sense than just like, oh yeah, slot 3 is this and slot 5 is this. And so anyway, so
I had the exact same experience, and I really appreciate it. By playing with Zoom, it just lets you save it as a file. Looking at it, I seem to have numbered them 001, 3 digits. So look at me. Look, you think I'm going to use a lot of these? To 027. I actually have 29 of them. So I didn't even save properly. It looks like I reused a couple numbers. Okay.
Now I think I'll try Zoom next time. I was not aware of that before that mail came in. So
yeah, it worked remarkably well. I was really happy with it. So it's an excellent choice for playing these games on modern Mac.
All right, so Trinity, I'm going to describe the box, which I'm looking at as a sort of a spinnable PDF sort of weird thing on the Lost Treasures app. On it is the front cover is a sundial, including mostly the part of the sundial that I now know is called a gnomon. I don't know how to pronounce it. Gnomon?
I think Gnomon because they make a joke about Gnomon as an island in the game. So it's a cringeworthy joke in the game.
the Gnomon of a sundial, and behind it, a nuclear explosion, a atom bomb going off. And the cover is all in oranges and yellows, and it says, "The basic power of the universe has been unleashed." And it says, Infocom, and trying to see what level it says. So I'm flipping over to the back of this weird little, it's hard to navigate this little interface here, but it says, "The time is out of joint, oh cursed sprite. That's all I was born to set it right. Hamlet." And it says, "It's the last day of your 599 London vacation. Unfortunately, it's also the first day of World War III. Only seconds remain before an H-bomb vaporizes the city, and you with it, unless you escape to another time, another dimension. For every atomic explosion unlocks the door to a secret universe, a plane between fantasy and reality, filled with curious artifacts and governed by its own mischievous logic. You'll crisscross time and space as you explore this fascinating universe, looking to control its inexorable power. Trinity leads you on a journey back to the dawn of the atomic age and puts the course of history in your hands."
Ooh, sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
It is good, too. I will start off by saying I really, really liked this game. I crazy liked this game.
Yeah?
Yeah, loved it. Loved this game. And yet, I quibble with the ending like crazy. When we're on the other side of the spoiler fence, I'm going to be talking about this ending. Oh my goodness, this ending. But overall, I adored the game.
I liked it a lot. I felt like after I picked it, I really didn't know anything about it except like when I picked it last time, except for time travel and nuclear explosions. And then I started doing some light research before I started playing. And I found out then that it is like regarded as one of the best Infocom games. And Jimmy Maurer was just like, this is like the pinnacle of the Infocom, you know, works. And I'm just like, wow. So that really set me up. And then, you know, it's just like you go into a movie going like, this is going to be great. And then, you know, so I didn't know what to expect.
Yeah, I'm actually almost glad that I didn't know that going in. That I just, for me, it was just yet another Infocom game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I liked it. I enjoyed it. I don't think I liked it as much as you. I might have even liked Ballyhoo more, frankly.
Ballyhoo's funnier.
Ballyhoo's funnier.
I mean, there's some funny bits in this, but this is I wouldn't say a total downer, but it's dealing with, you know, atomic explosions and World War III and lots of death, and so it's a bit morbid.
This is a tragedy. I mean, really, I would say it's more than a bit morbid. I'd say that this is a tragedy. I don't know how else to say it. It's a sad story.
I completely agree. And the structure of it as a game is different than what we've played before as well. It's a time travel game, so you can imagine you're like jumping back and forth. But it's actually, I guess I would say that it's divided into three parts. There's an initial part where the game just sort of kicks you off, and there's an initial little story mm-hmm. with its own little tiny map, and that is just you're an American tourist at the last day of your holiday in London, right before basically everything is going to go to heck in World War III. Like, right. So there's an hour left in the world, and you don't know that. And it's a neat little map of maybe 10 locations or something like that with just a couple little puzzles, and nice and easy, and it sort of kicks off the game.
I solved those first puzzles without cheating, and I'm just like, this is going to be great. I'm doing great. This game's so...
I solved all the first puzzles except the last of the first puzzles. I solved there's a... What really the main puzzle, the thing that would trip up most people to sort of get you to the exit of this map. Mm-hmm. And I did that no problem. I was solving all the puzzles. I too was feeling amazing. And then I'm there, and there's basically a door, and you've got a few turns to just like go through the door. I couldn't go through the door. Like, it just, I kept saying, go to the door. We can't go to the door. I'm like, I know I want to go to the door. Why can't I get in the door?
You really need to get to the door.
And I just didn't think to just try one of the cardinal directions, like move in that way, and that brings you to the door. And I actually had to look that up, and I felt terrible. I was like, oh my goodness, I'm looking up a cheat, and I'm 10 minutes into this game. So there's that first section, and I liked it. I like the phrasing of it. I find that this game is philosophical. It's the writing is evocative, and I just really like that. Mm-hmm. And then you move from that little opening area into the middle part of the game, which it takes really like 50% of the game, but most of the locations. And that's I guess you'd say it's like a nexus. So mm-hmm. there's a big central world that's very fantasy oriented. So you move from the real world of London, although near future London, into a fantasy landscape, like something out of an Alice in Wonderland kind of setting, mm-hmm. and with ogres and magic and that sort of thing. And there are from there seven more doors that can take you to other worlds. And so this middle part of the game, you're returning to this nexus, figuring out some puzzles, opens a door, takes you off to another world, like another part of Earth, the real Earth, either in the past or a speculative one in the future,
right.
All to do with war. And then you'll come back to the Nexus, and once you solve six of those locations, you unlock the seventh door, and then you go into the final, the third part of the game, which takes place at the Trinity test, and that where the game gets its name. And that's really like a smaller part than the second section, but I found much more difficult, and I spent a ton of time on it, and mm-hmm. it's very, very difficult. That third section amps up the difficulty, I think, quite a bit.
Yes, yeah, and I felt that the tone and style of the game changes for that third section kind of dramatically.
I agree.
I mean, all of a sudden there's this time pressure that doesn't really exist before in most of it, and the style sort of changes a little bit. And then there's kind of a fourth, there's kind of a afterword.
Right. I just was bringing it. Yeah. And there is kind of an afterworld thing, which is really hard to discuss without getting spoilery. But yes, you're right. There's a kind of a fourth thing. But yeah. I would kind of argue that the game really has three sections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And as long as we're talking about the parts of it, I wanted to, I threw together a spreadsheet of the the kind of the relative sizes of different Infocom
games. I saw that, actually. I really liked your spreadsheet.
Thank you. There'll be a link to that in our show notes if anyone else wants to see it. But so just kind of as a starting, just for Zork, just kind of as a baseline, Zork has 110 rooms, has a vocabulary of 697 words and 60 objects. Ballyhoo, which we did last time, has only 36 rooms.
In fact, I'm surprised it had that many. It felt even smaller than mm-hmm. that.
A vocabulary of 962 words and Ooh. Only 42 objects. And Trinity has 134 rooms, so good number more than Zork, a vocabulary of 2,120 words, which is the largest of any Infocom game, and 49 objects.
The weird thing is, I wouldn't have guessed that this had a vocabulary like three times the size of Zork.
No, me neither. Although I did, once I knew that, I started trying to use a lot of synonyms for things. You know, I would call the thing the pot instead of the cauldron, and it knew what I was talking about. So maybe
I call the pot black.
So anyway, that was kind of interesting. The average Infocom game, by the way, has 81 rooms, vocabulary of 976 words, and 44 objects.
So this then is above average in all of those.
Yes.
And way above average in vocabulary.
Yeah, in vocabulary, it's the most. Another thing I liked about it, and kind of the this game used a more advanced version of the Infocom engine, that one of its abilities is the ability to throw up quotes at apropos times on the screen. And I found I thought I would be annoyed by it, but I found I really enjoyed it. There would be whatever, you'd see a sundial and then a quote would come up, you know, from Alice in Wonderland about the sundial or, you know, something like that. And it would just kind of pop up a window on the screen, and that way they could pull in things from literature. And I enjoyed that.
I enjoyed it a lot too, in part because one of the quotes is from Alexander Pope, who's one of my favorite authors.
Hmm.
So there's a quote from An Essay on Man. I am weirdly a big fan of early 18th century literature.
That is weird.
So yeah, the Augustan age is my jam. So like Pope and Swift and Dryden and Addison and all that lot. I dig me a mock epic. So I was like, hey, you're quoting Pope. I'm on board. So. Yeah, although I prefer An Essay on Criticism to An Essay on Man, just, you know, for the record.
Okay.
Just saying.
I haven't read any of this. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Oh, highly recommended. Very, okay. Very funny stuff.
Well, you start a podcast about that, and I'll listen to it.
I will have one listener. So I really liked this game. I did like the fact that it seemed to start relatively easy and get relatively hard versus just throw me in and not be able to do anything. So mm-hmm. that means by the time I was really starting to get stuck, I was well invested into the game. But the thing that I liked most of all was the writing. I found it super evocative and part of it really funny, and would sort of just like set a mood and set lots of different moods, and just the actual phrasing, like to like sort of enjoy the literature of the game, was a new experience, and I just thought it was crazy. I kept writing down quotes and examples of things, and just like for instance, I'm going to just pick one at random. Mm-hmm. Okay, you're on the tower platform. A metal rail is all that stands between you and a 100-foot drop. Miles of barren desert lie below, gray and still in the gathering dawn. Black roads radiate outward like the hands of a great clock. Like, that's amazingly evocative. Like, you can see that the railing. And what I like is, like, this is a good example because the game is not just evocative of place and mood, but calls back images and metaphors from itself over and over again. Like, this idea of standing there and looking out at a great clock is a thing that happens in the game. There is a sort of a clock you manipulate in the middle of that nexus, and clockwork and the sundial, and like those, the same images and metaphors get used over and over and get layered. Mm-hmm. And I really enjoyed it. It was like playing a game and also kind of reading poetry. So I really just got into the writing of this game and found it very enjoyable.
Oh, good. Glad. Yeah, it was written by Brian Moriarty, who also did Wishbringer and before this, and then later he would do Beyond Zork. He also wrote for one of the Atari magazines, so he's kind of like a special place in my heart because he wrote for some games for Analog Computing, which two of them were also text adventures, although much simpler than an Infocom game. He did one called Adventure in the Fifth Dimension and one called Crash Dive, which is notable because if you don't know what you're doing, you will die on the third move. So, submarine.
You could die in this. This is a game, I will admit, does a thing that I'm not that keen on, where you can get into an unwinnable state. That happened to me a few times. Mm-hmm. There's like objects that will have limited use, and then when that use runs out, too bad for you. I hope you have a save you can go back to.
Yeah.
And I don't like that. I think that's a bad part of gaming.
Yes, definitely. And when I got to the third major section of the game several times, because once you go there, you can't go back. You're just, once you're in that third part, that's where you are. And
you better have brought with you everything.
Several times I didn't have all the things I needed, and then it's like, shoot, I've got to restore and go back and bring this other thing, and oh wait, I get halfway through it, like, oh, I still don't have this other object I didn't know I needed before. So I found that frustrating. There's also another part of the game which is just super mean, where it puts you in a situation where you are going to die in two moves. You like, you're teleported to a new place and you have two moves. And if you didn't bring everything you needed, you're dead. And it's just like super cruel. I mean, just cruel, you know?
It also makes you kill an animal. And I found that's a time where I cheated, is I looked to see, is there a way to not kill an animal? So I don't want to get spoilery, but just a heads up for people who want to play this and don't go on the other side of the spoiler fence. That I found it kind of disturbing, like that you actually have to just choose to, with your own hands, I'm just going to like kill this animal now.
Yeah.
And I was like, I really didn't want to. And I looked up cheats and nope, you must. Like one of the puzzle solutions will be to grab this small animal that's not in any way threatening you and hanging out with you. And you're just going to say, no, I'm going to just choose now to kill it solve a puzzle.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it.
But I think, I feel like that was getting toward the kind of an overarching point of the game, or that like, you know, you set
I found off, it fitting.
Fitting. I mean, if you set off a nuclear bomb, you're killing millions of people, you know, billions
but
of people.
But it's harder to, it's one of those things that's hard to conceptualize, killing millions of people, which is why we're afraid of it. But killing one innocent thing in your hands, it's like, did not like it.
And there's another section where, or a couple of other sections, where there is a innocent, lovely, kind animal that dies because of a explosion, you know, and it's sad every time, you know.
So I agree. So I mean, it's a sad game. This isn't a game that I guess is trying to leave you happy. It's when we get to the end, it's a game that's trying to leave you in a confused state, maybe, because that ending is but there are, it's a downer, and it's exploring a down idea, and I think it's doing it with proper reverence and proper mid-1980s fear. It's important, I think, when you play this game, is to remember the context, which is the middle of the 1980s, where it just felt like the world was a minute from maybe America and Russia just going crazy.
Yeah.
And that's where this game comes out of that and lives in that fear, and it's very much a game of its time.
Absolutely. Yeah, the digital I can never say that word. Jimmy Morrow's blog did a series of six posts about Trinity, and they're very long and very good. But the first one really does a great job of setting the stage of like what the situation was like, and with, you know, with Russia and Gorbachev and Reagan and the nuclear, you know, kind of where things were. If you're too young to remember, or so old that you don't want to remember, it really kind of puts the game in its context in a really nice way.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I agree. Like, you got to, this is a time when Star Wars meant something different. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, there was our Star Wars too, but then there was this period in the 80s where it's like, let's make another Star Wars that will get the Russians really upset and maybe just kill us all.
Yeah.
Boo to killing us all, says me and this game.
I agree. Not sure what else I have to say before
I would like to hop the spoiler fence, because I would like to talk about some specifics.
Yeah.
But before we do that, let's get to recommendations. So I would strongly recommend people to play this game. I think it's got tons to offer. It's quite difficult, but super rewarding, amazingly evocative. The puzzles are interesting. I found it very affecting, and I found the writing both beautiful and poetic and disturbing too, and I found it a gaming experience that's definitely going to stay with me, and I'm really glad I played it. So I strongly recommend this game.
I agree. It was very well written. Puzzles were tough, but okay,
and sometimes unfair, but you know, welcome to these games.
You're right. And thoughtful and evocative, and definitely, it is a great game. It really is. You've convinced me. No, you did. I mean, going into this, I was just like, I don't know. Maybe I like Ballyhoo better. And maybe I do. But I absolutely, this is a fine game and may turn out to be one of the best. So
I think so. I think 10 years from now, I'll remember that Ballyhoo was the funny circus one. Mm-hmm. But I think I will remember particular scenes from this game. Like, I think bits of this game will stay with me the way, like, a great game or even a great piece of literature or a great movie. You'll remember not just that you like it, but, there'll be images from it or scenes that will stick with you. And I think this game has a couple of those. Well, I mean, time will tell, but we'll see.
Right.
So let's hop the fence.
All right.
Let's hop the fence and talk spoiler. We're dropping the spoiler bomb now, baby.
That's right. This is the spoiler wall. If you do not want spoilers, stop listening now.
Yes, you can always come back. We will happily bring you back anytime in the future.
We'll still love you. Okay. We're now over the spoiler wall. Is it a fence or a wall?
A fence.
Okay.
You Americans and your walls.
I'm going to build a wall, and I'm going to make Brian Moriarty pay for it.
Excellent. Good plan. You tell me how that works out. Okay, so there are puzzles in here. I want to start with the, I think you often do fair and unfair or something like that.
Yes.
Is that how you do? Okay. So that had me thinking along the lines of fair and unfair when I played this game. And there's distinctly some unfair things that were interesting and cool, but like you were mentioning before, like there's times where you'll walk through these doors, like, you know, you're in the Nexus area, you open the doors into the mushrooms by rotating time. And that's really cool. Yeah. You grab this time dial and you twist it to rotate it and set the time where you want. And point a shadow at a door that opens up the door. You go in the door. That's great. What a neat way to work a Nexus. Mm-hmm. But you'll, like, one time I stepped through one of the white doors and I wrote down, and like you end up in a scene called Thin Air. You are 1,400 feet above a small city, falling straight down at a velocity of 70 miles an hour. I'm like, really? Like, okay now. And you better have with you a way to survive that.
Right.
I was like, okay. And that's an example of a bunch of points in this game where you kind of almost certainly will do an action that will kill you, and then you'll use the knowledge of having played that bit of the game to take another run or a couple of runs at it.
Ten or twelve runs.
Exactly. The same thing happened with going into orbit when you step through the door by the waterfall and you're into Earth orbit, and hopefully in a soap bubble. Of course, the first time you do it, you're not going to think to put yourself in a soap bubble.
This game literally puts you into the depths of outer space with no spacesuit. You're just in space. You have like two loops. First, it's like you feel your blood start to boil, and then it's like, then your lungs collapse or something, and you're dead in two moves. And yeah.
And this is an example of a puzzle that I needed a cheat to solve, because I was able to solve. I felt so proud of myself. I solved the soap bubble thing on my own. Mm. I was like, oh my goodness, I can do that. That'll give me air to breathe. It's amazing. So I stepped in with the giant soap bubble guy, got in my soap bubble, made sure I got to the door with enough turns so the soap bubble still existed. And suddenly I'm out in space and the bubble protects me and I can breathe. And I'm like, oh, this is incredible. I'm so smart. I'm so wonderful. But I could not think of the idea that you should use a magnetic lodestone to stick you to the side of a moving missile. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't solve that stupid puzzle. And so I end up having to look up a cheat and it'll tell you, hey, you got this magnet thing. I'm like, oh. And it's one of those puzzles where after the fact you think, oh, okay, yes, that works. But man, I could not solve that. I just like kept going into space and going into space and going into space and finally just gave up and looked up the answer. Mm. It was disappointing. I was really happy about figuring out the bubble, but really disappointed. And then after doing that, I had to look up another cheat to get out of the stupid bubble with the axe because I'd left the axe behind like ages before because I'd used it for something else. I'm thinking, I've used that tool. I don't need it anymore.
Right.
Nope, you need it again to pop your stupid air bubble. So I had to look up two cheats on one puzzle. That made me feel very, very not smart.
Oh, I looked up even more than that because I couldn't even get to the magnetic stone because it was too hot to pick up and I couldn't figure out how to cool it down. And which you have to use an icicle. I did manage to get the icicle on my own, so there's something to be said but for that.
Oh, but I had to restore on the icicle. Speaking of that, so I got the icicle on my own. I felt really good about that. And then you walk with the icicle, and the icicle is melting. You have to make sure that like halfway through your – because you can't make it all the way to the stone. So halfway through your mark, you have to go up to where this area is cold. And I totally got that because I was like, oh. Yeah, yeah. Because the first time you're wondering why it's always when I walk up here, it's like freezing cold. Why do you have that? It must be for a reason. So with the melting icicle, I totally solved the puzzle on my own, no problem. But then I took too long a route to get to the stone, so mm-hmm. the icicle melted. So I'm like, ah, no big deal. I'll take another run at it. You go back. No, there are no more icicles within reach. Like, so you only have one shot at the icicle. And I think that's bad game design. There's no reason why, maybe they can say you can only carry one icicle at a time because it'll slip out of your hands.
Right.
But there's no reason why the game couldn't have been designed that if you have to, you just simply go back and there's, you know, 100 icicles, you knock out another one and take another shot at it. Mm-hmm. Instead, I had to restore. And I thought that was just bad game design.
Mm-hmm.
Also, yeah. I'm just really upset that I took too long a path. Like, give me a stupid other icicle.
Yeah, and there were things about it I really liked. I mean, in the cottage, I liked the cottage a lot. I mean, it was sort of like there's this book there, which is like
the book. The book was amazing. It's what like, a moment in the game. Oh, yeah. And also, listener, if you're listening to this part and you haven't played the game, honestly, you don't want this part spoiled for you. So second spoiler fence, probably another little spoiler. You really don't want to know about the book because the book was just an amazing moment in gaming. Okay, let's move on past second spoiler fence.
So, I mean, just you read the book and it's you. You're in the book and it's you, the character, and it even lists like the last few moves that you make, which I just thought was adorable.
I thought so too. And you find out you are the Waby Walker, the keeper of Bergs. Mm-hmm. Just amazing. And it describes what's going on in like a descriptive heading and then a bunch of imperatives. And it goes, are these prayers? Are these formulae? And it's like, no, it's your things you are typing. Right. Just so, so great. And the Book of Hours, I think it was called. And mm-hmm. I just thought like that was wonderful that you find a book that is, and it made an interesting statement. And it's so easy to get into authorial tent and like just ascribe, once you really like a work, you want to think that everything about it's brilliant. Mm-hmm. But because this game is essentially operating on a loop, and we'll get to the end of this later where you're kind of back to the beginning. It's interesting though that this book, it ends, like it says the last few words are the ones that you have written. So you're creating a new story every time. So it's not that this is a world where itself it's on a loop, because you are going through this book the first time, at least, or is this supposed to be your first loop? Anyway, I found that interesting, that it's not a book. You think it would be a book that lists all of this and you're just in the middle, but it's sort of implying that you have free will, even though really you're going to be stuck on this loop forever.
Right. Interesting. And and I liked the map. There was a map there as well, which it's kind of like it's a map on the wall, but it all seems vaguely familiar. And then if you go away and you explore some more and you come back and look at the map, it says like the map has new squiggles on it that weren't there before.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, I just loved it.
I just really liked it. So, interesting as well, the corpse you find over with the a barrow white, but they do love their barrows. Infocom people are big fans of the Lord of the Rings and their barrow whites. And there's a corpse in there, and I'm pretty sure that corpse is supposed to be you.
Absolutely. I think it is, which I think is confusing. because
I thought so too, because you get the coins on yourself, and so it's wrapped up in the shroud that you're going to use later to cross the River Styx and go into the underworld, although it's not really the underworld, and yet you find the shroud on your own corpse. So it's like, well, when did the first loop happen?
Right. No, this is like this. I felt like, okay, this is clearly my character. This is going to end badly because I'm going to die. You know, you don't get out of this alive. And I felt that was, and yet, by the end of the game, it's clear that the player is in a loop and has to, like, in some sort of sci-fi sort of way, is like doomed to repeat this game over and over again and keep doing all these steps, like some sort of Twilight Zone thing, which I really thought was incompatible with the body.
I thought so too. And also, why would this body in this shroud be here anyway? Like, the location doesn't make sense if it's supposed to be you from another iteration. Why would you be? Anyway, like I think most time travel things, once you look too closely, it falls apart. That seems to be the nature of the genre.
Yeah.
And every looping thing always seems to fall apart on too close an inspection. So it's more that you have to kind of take it like the poetry it is. More just like, hey, don't worry so much about the details and look more at the feeling of it.
Right.
Speaking of the going across the River Styx, though, it was interesting that you know there's that word in your the voice in your ear that whispers.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in orbit, it says where Gnomon has gone before.
Right.
Because these pun comedies, which are sometimes more successful than others.
Mm-hmm.
At other times, it's kind of neat. Like when you're crossing the river, one time through, instead of saying look at the river, I said look at Styx. I called it the River Styx.
Mm-hmm.
And it says, oh, show off. It whispers in your ear. And then if you show off twice, like, so if you do the, you can, if you call like the fairy, instead of saying the ferryman, if you call him Karen, it'll say show off. But if you say look at Styx, it'll say show off. And then you say give silver coin to Karen, like you just say, I know, it'll say so educated. Giggles the voice in your ear. And so you can get the voice to giggle if instead of whisper if you show off enough. And so I played those little games with it. So it's fun that you can play games with the game.
Yeah. No, I wasn't smart enough to do any of that. I do know from reading the InvisiClues when I was done that at the end in the desert there's a thin man and you can call him Oppenheimer. And it because that's who it is. So, my favorite part, perhaps, was in Japan.
I had to cheat there too.
Yeah,
when you're in Nagasaki.
In Nagasaki or Hiroshima, wherever it is.
Well, I think it distinctly says Nagasaki somewhere, but it's got to be Hiroshima because the girl is that famous girl who's from Hiroshima who was folding the cranes. So that's why it kind of confused me. So I think it's supposed to be Hiroshima.
Why did you have to cheat about that before I go on?
Because I'm not a smart man, regardless of what the voice in my ear would giggle. Because, like, I survived the drop from the sky. You know, that's the one where you step out and like, hey, you're in the sky. Good luck for the next couple of turns.
Right, right.
And then I figured out to use the umbrella all on my own. I'm like, look at that. I've seen enough cartoons.
Right.
I know that umbrellas work as parachutes. So I'm like, excellent. And then I fall, and there's the little girl by a school, and she's about to... She looks at your umbrella with interest or whatever, and then is about to run off scream. And so I'm like, I can solve this puzzle easy. First try. Give her the umbrella. She finds it really interesting, calms her down. I'm like, look at me. I solved the little girl problem. But then, that was
the first time in your life.
I did with the act. Yeah. Well, no, but... having never done that before, I finally solved a girl problem. So, but I made a mistake here. Maybe it's bad game design. It's more bad game player. Just like with the axe, you know, you use something once and then you think, okay, I'm done with it. So I use the umbrella to not drop to my death. And I used it then. I give it to the girl. And I figured now the girl is not complaining anymore. She's done. But... And I just can't get out of that. I keep dying because you got to give her the paper to fold into the little crane. And there's folded paper cranes all over the place in this scene. And yet it doesn't occur to me to do that because I think, well, I'm done with the girl because I've given her the umbrella. And I don't think I should continue to interact with her and give her the origami paper. So when I looked that up, I felt like a like sets a total slowpoke. I'm like, oh, I should have solved that. But it's an example of, you know, you think a thing is used or a puzzle is done, so it's just right out of my mind now. I'm just looking at everything else. So unfortunately, I died there and had to cheat.
So speaking of being too dumb to realize something, did it occur to you that the old woman from the beginning of the game is the little girl from that section?
Oh, yes.
I missed that entirely.
Because of her face and stuff like that. Yeah, and there's so many things like that, the callbacks, and I found really effective. I didn't understand.
And she still has the umbrella. I mean, she's an old woman.
She still has the umbrella. Well, sure. So that didn't clue you in. Okay, I can go you one better, though. I thought she died.
I thought it was still poignant, but I really thought it was the most poignant moment of the game where you're here with this little girl and you kind of make friends with her and you give her the umbrella and then you get out of there and then the bomb falls and I'm just like, oh wow, you know, she's dead now, yikes, you know. But okay, she didn't die, she just got her face maimed and she managed to continue to live to the end of the game where she...
Well, I knew once I knew to give her the folding crane, I knew she was that famous little Japanese girl who there was a bunch of them that were like in that school or something, like 2-year-olds who were near the dropping of the bomb, mm-hmm. who then lived for a while and became, and the one girl some name that starts with S, was sort of famous for she wanted to fold like 1,000 origami cranes before she died, and then she didn't make it and stuff, and it was like a thing, right? So I was just aware of her, and so I was aware, oh, she's the back with the umbrella again, so I knew she was the little girl who didn't quite die in the blast, and just very, very poignant. But well, I got that, and that seemed obvious to me. Remarkably, crazily remarkably, I was well past halfway of this game when it finally occurred to me in the central nexus, which is like an Alice in Wonderland place with fairy tale stuff and giant bees and magic and an ogre and giant mushrooms everywhere. It didn't occur to me that, of course, the doors are in the mushroom because these mushrooms represent mushroom clouds. They're like, I was like, oh, mushroom. I must have been 20, 30 hours into this game before it hit me. Oh, that's why there's giant mushrooms everywhere that you're entering to go to the places where there's nuclear explosions.
Oh, see, the point at which I understood that was the point at which you told me. Oh.
But it's stuff like that where it's very metaphorical language and metaphorical landscape. But things like that, like, I completely missed that until well into the game. Where I'm like, oh, that's why there's mushrooms everywhere, because they're giant mushrooms. But just that's why I like the writing. I just think it's neat and does stuff like that. However, that I want to say it again, like, I loved the cottage and I loved having to cast the spell and I loved the book, but getting the ingredients to put into the pot to make the explosion and having to kill the skink. By the way, I never knew what a skink was. I had to look that up. I never knew the name of an animal, skink. And I kept looking up ways to not have to kill the skink, like the whole threshold to kill it in the light of a crescent moon. It's neat that you go into space and there's a crescent moon and so therefore you basically wring its neck. But it just, for some reason, that really affected me, having to grab this little skink that had been with me all this time and just pull it out of your pocket and snap its neck just so I can make a spell. I was like, oh, there's got to be another way.
I felt more sad. I mean, I get what you're saying. I'm not disagreeing with you. Well, I personally felt sad about the dolphin, who's this fun-loving creature out in the on the waters, and he bites the dust. And the Roadrunner, I thought, was
The Roadrunner is the best. He was a little, I love the Roadrunner.
Yeah, it was a little. I mean, he was a Floyd-like guy. You know, he hangs out with you and helps you solve things.
And helps you, like, actually help. Like, I loved the Roadrunner, and I felt terrible about the Roadrunner.
Yeah.
But at least I didn't like actively kill the Roadrunner.
Right.
But the Roadrunner was the best, and so helpful and fun, and kind of had a character. Right. I really ended up liking the Roadrunner, so I was very affected and trying to figure out how can I make the Roadrunner come with me or something, and there just isn't a way. Roadrunner's going to buy it, and that was very disappointing because I like the Roadrunner. In fact, in my notes, I've got Roadrunner is the best in my notes. I just love the Roadrunner.
Although the Roadrunner makes it to the end of the game because he's there and you're petting him at the very end right before everything ends, I believe.
Yeah, but stuck
in the loop.
So maybe the Roadrunner, because the Roadrunner maybe is back in the loop. You go back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is that same Roadrunner. Maybe you and the Roadrunner. You know what? The Roadrunner lives. Oh, good. Roadrunner comes back.
Talk yourself into that.
Right. Maybe every second play, you are the Roadrunner.
Oh, I like that.
Because Roadrunner knows what's going on from the beginning. Grabs the red gem you're going to need at the very end. So the Roadrunner gets it.
I like the Roadrunner. Who's Wile E. Coyote then?
Me.
Oh, okay.
Wavy Coyote.
Well done, sir.
So I didn't understand. Another thing that I didn't understand at first and then later figured that kind of made me feel dumb is in the middle of the desert, you're racing around with your quick boots and you find the Jeep and you find a wallet in the Jeep that you really do nothing with. But in the wallet is a snapshot that has a black and white snapshot of a little boy staring at the camera.
Yes.
And it says, the boy in the snapshot seems familiar. Maybe it's the wand he's holding. And I'm like, who's the boy? What's with this wand? Is it like a wizard? Is it like a Harry Potter thing?
It's the bubble boy.
It's the bubble wand, right? But it took me forever to figure that out.
But do you know, and maybe this is in reference to something that I'm not familiar with, who is the bubble boy? Is that a reference to something? Like, I didn't know who Sadako Sasaki was either. So.
Nope. And you go back to the boy when you encounter him again, and he's now giant, and which made me think of the fat lady in Ballyhoo, because I'm like another giant. Because when you encounter the boy like the second time, he says he's really large. I'm like, look at boys, like he's 40 feet tall or something. I'm like, okay, the boy has changed.
I just thought you meant he was kind of fat, but
it's like when he's 40 feet tall, it's like, okay. But then that's how you can use him to put you in a big bubble and stuff. Right. But I have no idea. I suspect it's supposed to be a reference to somebody in particular, but I do not know. I did not get that. So if a listener knows, let me know. But that did not – it's just this boy you encounter a few times, and he's going to get vaporized in London.
Yeah. This was the only Infocom game ever that included in the manual a list of references, because apparently Moriarty did all sorts of reading before this, and there's a list of like 20 books and articles and things about nuclear war and things like that. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was a reference to a real person or something.
So looking through my notes, I see that I was very proud of myself when I figured out the getting the honey, the reaching into the hive, and there's a giant bee appeared. Oh, I wrote down the giant bee spit polishes its stinger. I like how it comes out ready to get you. But then I remembered there was the giant Venus flytrap, and I'm like, I can totally solve this puzzle. And I felt so smart.
Oh, you are smart.
Like, run, get it eaten. Oh, I was like, oh, look at that. That's amazing. Look at me go. And I got the honey. Oh. And then very shortly after that, it took me forever to try to find where I could find milk. Now, meanwhile, in my inventory is a coconut. And it's like my brain was in two parts. Right. One part was saying, where can I find milk? And the other part was like, what do I do with this coconut? I should have had a third part saying, why don't we get you two guys together? But for the longest time, it's like, what do I do with this coconut? It's so useless. And then, like, where can I find milk? It's impossible. I just couldn't put those two things together for ages.
I felt so stupid about the bee thing. I was basically, the way you get it is you reach into the beehive and you take the honey.
It took me a long time to figure out to reach in, though.
Yeah, I was overthinking. I was like, tap the beehive with the icicle. No, that gets you dead. I tried putting things into the beehive because I didn't want to put my hand in there. That seemed like the obvious, stupidest thing
to do. I tried shaking it. I wanted to throw things at it.
Dead.
It took me forever. I reached in almost like sort of giving up.
Yeah, yeah. And when I finally cheated to find out how to get the honey, I had the honey, and then the bee's chasing me. I don't know what to do. So I realized if you kept moving, the bee doesn't get you. So I'm just like wandering around, and I accidentally went into the room with the fly trap, so I solved the puzzle completely by accident.
Because I made a beeline for the fly trap. I remembered it because I think I encountered it not too long before the hive, so it was fresh in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I didn't put things that made me feel proud to solve. I just did. I did the opposite. I wrote down every time I needed a hint. And so here's a partial list. I mean, to get the gnomon from the sundial, I didn't realize that it was unscrewable and you could take it. To get the honey in the hive, you had to reach in the hive twice. I didn't do that. The whole thing about activating the toadstool doors using the shadow, and then that you needed to stop the shadow in order to get back. I needed that spelled out for me in third grade handwriting. I just couldn't understand it. And then reversing, I sort of figured out on with a little bit of help about reversing the thread with the Klein bottle. Kind of
which is a good another good metaphor thing though, because you're kind of this game's like has no beginning and no end. It's the game's structured like a Klein bottle. Lots of metaphor.
Yeah.
It's a meaty game.
and the list goes on and on. I mean, I needed help for a lot of things, like either a push in the right direction or an outside or you know, just being told what to do. But like I said, I didn't really need a outright walkthrough until that final section of the game in the desert, because it's all very time sensitive.
And you have so little time until the very, very end, where I basically had to sit there twiddling my thumbs because I was too early and I kept cutting the wire way too early. So it's a crazy combination of go, 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 and then wait. I needed to cheat at the end. I found it very difficult. The fact that you have a limited number of moves and that everything's moving, suddenly now it's a clockwork game where everything's just going to tick along and you better be at this point by the time you're needed to. I found that very difficult. The ending is so difficult. And I also didn't like another animal I had to kill where you have to go into the who have you got in the cage? You have to get in the closet and there's a snake, the monkey or something?
Yeah, I forgot what it was. There's some sort of animal that you've got to feed to a snake.
Yeah. I felt really bad about that, going in and saying, well, I know how to do this.
It's a lemming.
It's a lemming. Yeah, which is a good metaphor, all those lemmings in the Russia thing, just like going off to the death. I'm like, yeah, well, you and me both, brother.
And then, so say we all. Yeah.
Yeah, except, but then having to like go into the closet and then like just open the cage, then know that it's on the ground, and then just open the door and let the snake kill the thing. I'm like, oh, poor, sorry, little guy.
Yeah.
Better than losing the Roadrunner there, though. I like the
Roadrunner. That's true. Yeah, the Roadrunner was a pal.
And I liked, so using the Roadrunner to fetch things was a neat, like, where you can, like, use the binoculars to look at the fellow in the distance, and you need something, I can't remember, a tool or something from him, and you can just point at it, and the Roadrunner, a key, and the Roadrunner would go off and get it to you and bring it. I'm like, yeah. that is great.
In the walkthrough I saw, after I had solved it, it said point to key, and then Roadrunner would do it. When I did it on my own was Roadrunner, comma, get the key, and he would do it, which was very consistent with what I had done before, which was Dolphin, comma, get the coconut. So, you know, I liked that was self-consistent within the game.
I agree. When I did it as well, I instructed the Roadrunner to do stuff.
Yeah.
Except for the breadcrumbs, which I just left on for the dog, or in front of the dog, when you have to use the... And that's where I kept dying at the end, was I would try to climb the tower, and I would get spotted, like, over and over and over and over again. And I'm like, what the hell do I got to do? Like, I think I've solved everything. I don't understand. How is it possible to not just die in this... I think they list as a multi-megaton blast, which should have occurred to me then. That's a very large blast. Multi-megaton? Isn't, like... 50 megaton, like the most ever. This is some crazy thing, or multi-gigaton blast. That was right. I was like, that. What?
Well,
what
I think the idea, and I only got this from reading afterwards.
So should we talk about? We should talk about now the ending. Like, what is you actually accomplish
in
this thing?
Fine. Let's talk about the ending.
The multi-megaton.
Yeah, it seems, and I'm. This is not my original idea. This is in some sort of world where the nuclear bombs blew up more than they do in our reality. They are bigger. And when this bomb goes off accidentally, in a failed game, it says it blows up three quarters of Nevada or something like that. The explosion are too big. And something about what the player does in cutting the wire is makes the explosion smaller and more manageable. From
it
not
doesn't
only
make any sense to me.
No, for not only for that explosion, but somehow for all nuclear explosions in the future.
Right. It basically changes physics, as far as I can tell.
Right.
And it says, now nuclear explosions will be a thousand times less than they would. So it doesn't get rid of them. It doesn't say, let's make these things not work. And no, we have them still work and be still awful, but they won't be. Like, they'll be a thousand times less awful, so they won't basically destroy the whole planet. They'll just destroy whole cities. It's a very weird choice for an ending. And I give it a lot of thought to think, well, what would I have done differently? Like, if you get to this point, what ending was I expecting? But I don't know. But I wasn't expecting this, and I found it suitable but unsatisfying. Because at first I wasn't even sure, like, did I get the right ending? Because there's lots of ways to die where you're just like, nah, river sticks and out you go. So I was frequently being killed by the blast. And so suddenly I did what seemed to be the correct final solution with the correct final timing and waiting for that stinking auto something to kick in.
The auto synchronizer or whatever it was. Oh, yeah.
That's what I forgot to do and so many times died because I didn't.
And what frustrated me at the end is there's a point where they tell the military folks all have to face away from the blast target. I'm like, okay, that's it. No one's looking. I can do what I want now. And still, they managed to catch me. I'm just like, that doesn't make sense to me. But
I thought so, too.
Yeah.
It was bugging me. Yeah. I kept thinking, well, maybe they're seeing me on a video monitor or something. Because I kept thinking that was, if I waited until they said that, maybe I have to, like, within a couple of turns, climb the tower or something. Like, it threw me off as well. Yeah. But I don't know. Like, I love this game, but this weird ending where you snip a wire and then that changes physics, I guess, and then the voice, which might have been the voice of you or the voice of the author, I guess,
I always assumed that voice was Brian Moriarty, but...
Yeah, and saying, okay, well, you know, but physics won't allow a paradox, so I guess what really happened is you snipped it, which would have disabled it, but you can't disable it, because if you disable it, then the explosion wouldn't have happened, which opens up the first mushroom door that sends you back in time, so there'd be a paradox. So it says, well, instead of getting rid of it, we'll just make them smaller and throw you into a loop where you'll have to do this for all eternity. So you become like a Sisyphus or something. And it's just, it's kind of unsatisfying for a game that I really liked. You just, boom, like it's just, you're back at the beginning of the game. Though you can't, I thought, well, do I play the game? And about an hour before we recorded, it hit me, I wonder if I didn't actually finish. Like, am I supposed to go in and go through that door again? Because I didn't. But then if you play it, you never have enough time to go through that first door again. So it just, after a few turns, the game just ends and that's it. And I don't know, like, if I snipped the bomb and I stopped it from happening, would that have been more satisfying? But it'd be kind of like a little bit mawkish to say, oh, you've stopped all the bad stuff and everything will be fine. I don't know if that would have read well, I guess. So I don't know. I don't know what different ending I would suggest. Mm-hmm. But I did find the ending a little unsatisfying, effective and affecting. It's going to stay with me, but a little confusing. It's like the end of an art house film where the lights come on. You're like, what just happened there? What is that last scene again?
Yeah, this was an art house film. I mean, yeah, that's a really good comparison. It's kind of dark and a little confusing, and
but if it was an art house film, it's
something
called,
that you'll
it
be thinking
been called
about.
Bubble wand to make you really think that was like the main point or something.
Right. Boy in the bubble or something.
I mean, I still really dug it.
Yeah,
and I think it is an example of Infocom pushing boundaries with story and with the nature of story and saying things that are a little more philosophical and have something more to them than say Zork does. Like it's a richer text, which means it's also a little heavy. Like something like Ballyhoo is lighter and more fun and much funnier. Mm-hmm. So I would frequently be more in the mood for something like Ballyhoo. That is for sure. If all Infocom games were like Trinity, I don't think I would go through all Infocom games. It's a heavy thing with a very weird ending, but I'm still very glad I did it. I think it's a rewarding game.
You're saying it's a great game to have played.
Exactly. And a very frustrating game to play because you have to cheat and it's a bit of a downer.
Yeah.
But I still liked it though. I liked it lots. But that ending, man, that is a tough final section.
Yes, indeed.
What's the rating of this game? Is it considered intermediate or
this
tough?
This was standard.
Wow. Holy moly. When we get to the hard ones, they're going to kick my butt.
I think that they might have had the best of intentions with that rating system, but ultimately marketing had to have gone, like, we can't have advanced games. That's going to scare people off. And we can't have beginner games because people are going to think after they've ever played an Infocom game, they're going to think they're too advanced for them. And I think, you know, everything had to be standard. I mean, Hitchhikers was standard, and that is one of the hardest games.
Notoriously, hard. So.
That's not a, you know, that's like an expert game. So I don't know. I think that the rating system had to have gotten compromised by marketing aspects early on.
That's a really good point. I hadn't really thought of that. I agree. I bet you it did.
Yeah.
You've persuaded me.
Okay, good.
So I dig it. I will not change my my rating on this. Good game. A good game well played.
This game was a blast. It was the bomb.
You know what the mushrooms are? They're metaphors. So shall we pick another game?
I think you should. I picked this one. I think you should pick the next one.
Then I think we should play a game. Since this Trinity's a game I'd always wanted to play, and I think we should now play one of the ones I never wanted to play. Let's see if one of the ones that I always thought looked boring turns out to actually be good.
Okay.
So I always shied away from both Sea Stalker and I think it was called Border Zone. So those both of those games I always thought looked awful. So I think we should play one of those two.
Okay.
Which of those bad games would you like to play?
I think Sea Stalker is a junior level game.
Could be good for my ego.
What's that?
Could be good for my ego.
Yeah, yeah. Let's do Sea Stalker. I have two reasons. Okay. One, I think after the darkness of Trinity, we could use something a little lighter and simpler. And on a personal note, it is about time for my favorite annual programming competition, the 10-line basic programming contest. And that's going to distract me a little bit. So I would like a slightly easier game, I think, too.
Perfect choice.
Yeah.
Excellent. We'll do Sea Stalker. And then you will redo Sea Stalker as a 10-line basic
Well, you know, last year I did a text adventure in a 10-line basic Atari basic program.
See? There you go.
Yeah. It was not very good.
So I guess if you've already done one game, this time what you should do is redo the entirety of The Lost Treasures of Infocom, both Volume 1 and Volume 2, as a 10-line basic
game. Okay, great. I'll see what I can do.
Yeah, excellent. I expect it by Wednesday.
Okay.
All right. Holding you to a high standard. Well, thank you very much for podcasting with me.
Thank you, Carrington.
That was super fun, as always. And thank you, listener, for listening. This has been Eaten by
Good
a
Group
Infocom
listener.
Podcast. Good job. You listened well. I'd love to hear from people who played along. Like, did you finish Trinity? What did you think? Philosophical masterpiece or too difficult or a silly ending? Are we wrong about the ending? Write in. Let us know. Maybe there's like a whole different way to interpret
Explain this. The
or maybe there's
to
a
us.
Better ending. Neither of us got. You can email us at Groove, that's GRUE, at monsterfeet.com, or hit us up on Twitter, which is nice and easier. He is at Kevin Savage. I'm at Carrington, or if you want to be an extra special best friend, you could give us a nice review on iTunes. Show notes and links can be found at monsterfeet.com, and thanks to MC Frontalot for letting us use his dope rhymes for our theme song. Dope rhymes, that's what the kids say, right?
I think so, yeah.
Excellent. And we will see you in a month-ish.
Bye.
Bye.
Walked into the slavering fangs of a lurking Gru.
I thought it was a blast.
Oh. What's the hang-up sound again?